Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset, your home for news in Chicago and beyond. Asylum seekers are still arriving at Chicago bus stations as Texas Governor Greg Abbott continues his political stunt. 48 more migrants came to the city on Friday, totaling some 650 new people in the city. After a long journey to an unknown place, what do the asylum seekers need now and down the road? And how are local volunteers stepping up to help? Here with us is Joannis Favi, Director of the Chicago Immigrant Transit Assistance Program with the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants. We're also joined by Laura Mendoza, organizer with the Resurrection Project. Laura, you went to meet a bus on Friday. What was the mood?
I've been there since it started about 19 days ago. And so the mood is very much the same. People are tired. People have been on those buses for 24 hours. They've been on a 3-month journey. Mm-hmm. So they're just relieved to see a welcoming face, to know that they're going to have somewhere to sleep, that they're going to have food, and that they're going to be able to take a warm shower.
Yeah.
They're relieved that there is like this effort from the city and from the state and from the non-for-profits to receive them and to help them as they navigate this new stage in their lives.
You know, one of the things we've been hearing over and over throughout this process is city leaders don't know when these buses are coming. How is it that you're finding out when these migrant buses are going to arrive?
Yeah, I mean, through a lot of networks. And we're also working with the city. And a lot of it is we have volunteers who just will wait at Union Station. I think we've waited for like 2-3 hours sometimes. And so you're just standing outside. Yeah, which is doable right now. And we are definitely thinking about like when winter comes, you know, that gets
What's
even
that
more
be
difficult.
Like? Yeah. Joannis, people have been in dangerous, physically grueling situations, sometimes for months at a time. Many enter immigration detention, they're released, and then they're put on this bus to a city that they've presumably never even been to before. Many are arriving when it's dark. This is all objectively, to me, terrifying and anxiety-inducing, just to say the least. So what are you hearing, Joannis, from people, you know, once they do get here, what are they saying?
Well, when my volunteer greet people at the Greyhound station, they immediately assess the need, ask them what do they need. The first thing we notice, sometimes people don't know how to read and they can miss the bus and then they can be stranded and then they're exhausted, they're hungry and desperate, they're lost, they need help. Hmm. So we buy them food, hot meal, coffee, and get them on the other side of the Greyhound station and give them a set of clothes, wipes, because we don't have a place for them to get a warm shower like Laura said earlier. But we uphold their dignity by giving them new clothes and food and help them get a new ticket so they can continue the journey. Now, for the one that choose to stay here in Chicago, we have a housing program, and then we refer them to our housing program. But at the moment, we have capacity because the crisis happening.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that housing program, Joannis. Do some of them have friends and family here?
Well, the way it works is when people were working together for the past 2 months, let's say from Colombia to arrive to the United States, it takes them about 2 months. And then they make friends on the road that often have family or friends in the U.S. and they pass contact to one another. And when they arrive, they try to get together with their friends in Chicago. So yes, some people have a friend or family here.
Even still, it sounds like new friends, right? Newfound friends that will eventually become, you know, the family you choose, right? Do people, Laura, have physical injuries that need to be dealt with when they get here? And I wonder how you and volunteers help meet those needs.
Yeah, so we are working with the City of Chicago in collaboration with the City of Chicago, the Office of Emergency Management. And so there are paramedics on site when the buses do arrive. So we do ask first thing we ask is if anybody has any emergency, any medical need that needs to be addressed immediately. Mm-hmm. What we are seeing is definitely a lot of dehydration, swollen legs, like extremely swollen legs. You know, sometimes just like scratches from like all of the journey that they've had, or like injuries on, especially on their legs, is what we've been
swollen
seeing.
Legs probably from sitting for so long, right? Having your legs right. just
correct, yeah,
hang.
from all the sitting and not having enough water either on those buses.
Joanna, back to you. You're leading the interfaith community for detained immigrants, and for years you have been coordinating volunteers to meet immigrants at the Greyhound station and the Union stations when they get here. You're now sending these experienced volunteers to do the same thing for these buses that are arriving here from Texas. Anything that you're seeing different now with these buses that are arriving?
The only difference is that they have media attention. We've been dealing with this issue for many years. And in the month of July, we serve about 75 people. In the month of August, we serve about 62 people. And they need the same housing. And for the one that will remain in Chicago, employment authorization document, so they can sustain themselves.
Talk more about that housing program you mentioned earlier. What goes into finding them places to stay?
It takes a lot of liabilities to house someone. You have to care for them just like you care for your children. So you have to think about healthcare. You have to think about school for the kid. You have to think about mental health, because most of these people are traumatized. They've been through a horrific situation, rape, gang violence, just name it. And we pay for those needs. We get them to see medical specialists to help them. And then we help the kid go to school. And then you have to provide food, you know, on a daily basis. And it takes up to a year for someone to receive their employment authorization document, and for us to get them through our housing program so they can be independent.
But you said earlier you're at capacity now.
Yes, we're at capacity. We are taking care of right now.
Laura, what local shelters are taking these asylum seekers?
So the city is working with Reynow Salvation Army, and they're also working on setting up alternative shelters. I mean, we know the shelter system is also at capacity. They're not going to have enough beds, especially with the frequency that we're receiving buses and the amount of people that we're receiving. So there is kind of an ongoing plan, kind of building the plane while you're flying it as to, like, what are some other alternatives, other places where
are local families an option? Can some stay with...
it's not necessarily part of the city program, but I mean, it's basically what Johannes mentioned, right? Like people are meeting people on the road, and some of those friends that are here in the city have opened their doors and are taking in people, but it's not necessarily like a very intentional part of it. It just happens kind of organically.
What about churches?
Some churches have taken also some individuals. Again, it's just a matter of like the demand is very high. And there are certain things logistically that can also make it difficult. Things like even, you know, having showers at the churches, right, can be like a logistical issue as to why they can't really host a lot of people. There's also the, you know, separating by gender, men, women quarters, also makes it difficult. And then you do have families that are coming in as well. So all of those play.
Yeah. And those shelters you mentioned, like the Salvation Army, for instance, how long can they stay there?
That's a really good question. I think we're not sure yet. I think the hope is that they're able to transition quickly, but that's not really happening, right? Because there is the issue of like being able to work. And if immigration's taking about a year, or longer, you know, in some of these cases, that means people aren't going to have very steady work.
Yeah.
And so it's something that we're still trying to figure out.
Just a thought. Yeah. This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. If you're just tuning in, our guests are Joannes Favi with the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants and Laura Mendoza with the Resurrection Project. They've been meeting new arriving asylum seekers as they get here in Chicago from Texas. You mentioned this earlier, the seasons are changing. Winter, Laura, is around the corner. will there be capacity to house not just these incoming asylum seekers, but the city's homeless population?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big worry. That's on everybody's mind. And I think the city's definitely working to try to figure out what could be a solution for that, to like make sure that there are enough shelters for the current population in Chicago and then the incoming immigrants that are arriving.
And Joanna, you know, from what we know, it's likely that Governor Abbott in Texas is going to send more asylum seekers here to Chicago, which means continued community support. That's going to be very critical. So what do you want to see from volunteers moving forward?
From volunteers, I would like to ask people not only to volunteer and help, but also donate to help these families. And the need just will keep increasing. And we definitely have to think about an exit plan. Housing them in shelter is just a bandit. Giving them food is just a bandit. We definitely need to advocate and make sure that they receive work permit so they can sustain themselves. That's the end goal.
Mm. What kinds of conversations are you having with some of the other community organizers about just keeping this up, maintaining?
Meeting with our representative and asking them to push forward to the capital, and hopefully, let's say, the federal government will allow them to work.
Yeah. You immigrated to the U.S. yourself, Joanna. So you've been through this system. You experienced firsthand what it was like to be detained. What is it like now for you to have volunteers, or what was it like then, I should ask, for you back then, having volunteers reach out and help when you were detained?
Well, I will just be really honest with you. Unless you really go through this, you cannot care deeply for these people. The needs are so many. And going through detention is horrific. Not having the right to work and being permitted to live in the United States is horrific. The government should not let people in if they cannot give them an authorization to work. That is keeping them in a prison and forcing them to commit crime to go back to the system. It's set up. So we definitely need to advocate and have the government allow people to work when they permit them to enter the United States.
That's a huge factor here. Laura, anything to add?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's something that needs to happen in order for us to be able, because like Johanna said, it is a Band-Aid.
If you can't work, what can you do?
Exactly.
How can you provide for your family?
Exactly. And it also, I mean, it opens up people to a vulnerable position, right? Because just because you don't have that permit doesn't mean people aren't going to, you know, try to figure out how to work, which makes them a lot more vulnerable. And people do take advantage of those situations. And that's something that's definitely on our mind. Like, how do we prevent that from happening? And we can't. We can only let them know their rights in the U.S. and what should be the amount that they should be paid, the hours that they should be working.
And these work permits, is it our city or state that can help with this?
That's all through the federal government. Yeah. So that's all the federal government that they would have to figure out how to do this.
Yeah. Last word to you here, Joannis, before we take a break. What's needed right now? How can people listening help out? You mentioned earlier volunteering and donations, right?
Yes, we have a link on our website, icdichicago.org, for donation through our Amazon wish list. And people can support us, help replenish our storage unit. We've been forwarding out the donation to the state and to help directly the people that are coming from the Texas Purse. So all information are on our website.
That was Joannis Favi, director of the Chicago Immigrant Transit Assistance Program. Thank you so much, Joannis. Let's continue the conversation about the more than 650 asylum seekers who've been bused to Chicago over the past 2 weeks. The asylum application process is long and complicated, with people waiting 6 months after they apply to get work authorization. So how do the long-term needs of migrants get addressed? Laura Mendoza, immigrant organizer with the Resurrection Project, is still with us. And joining us now is Ed Pratt, director of the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants. And to give us legal context is Nicole Hallett, director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago's Law School. Nicole, I'll start with you. What do we mean when we say asylum seeker? And how is this different from other forms of immigration?
Well, most of the people who are being bused to Chicago arrived in the United States at the southern border. And when you arrive in the United States and you do not have a visa and you're not a citizen, most of those people are sort of turned back immediately or deported immediately. There is an exception in the law for individuals who claim that they are afraid of returning to their home country. They get put into a separate process. And if they pass through that initial process, then many of them are released into the United States and given the opportunity to apply for asylum. That process sometimes takes years. But when we say asylum seeker, what we mean is that these are individuals that have expressed to the U.S. government that they intend to apply for asylum and will be given an opportunity to do so.
You know, we now have over 650 people here in Chicago who presumably are going to start this process that you've just outlined for us. Is there enough capacity to help everyone with the process?
So, you know, in terms of capacity, these people will be going through immigration court hearings, and there isn't enough capacity. The immigration court system right now has, I think, more than a million cases that are pending. It often takes many years for people's cases to be heard. But this isn't a problem that just applies to these 650 people. This applies to anybody who's in the immigration system in the United States. And these individuals will simply, you know, get in line with everybody else that has these hearings. And like I said, it could take years for them to get an answer on their application.
People seeking asylum, they've got to wait 6 months before they can get work authorization. Why is that? Usually.
Well, I mean, that's just the way that the law has been written. You know, it's sort of assumed, I think it was assumed initially that most people's applications would be resolved within 6 months. And so, you know, with such a short period of time, the thought was, I think, that they didn't need to work. That's obviously not the way it works now. It takes many years, but that 6 month requirement is still in the law.
Yeah.
And I guess I should say it's not 6 months from when they enter the United States. It's 6 months from when they actually file their asylum application, which they're required to do within the first year after they enter the United States.
Oh, I see.
So conceivably, it could be, you know, up to a year and a half, depending on when they file their asylum application, before they can even file an application for work authorization. And then it sometimes takes months for that application to be adjudicated.
If they're found to be working under the table in that time, how does this harm their asylum process?
Well, I should just say that, of course, if you don't have work authorization in the United States, you cannot legally work. However, many asylum seekers do work under the table, and that won't affect whether they can get asylum at the end of the day. It wouldn't bar them from getting asylum, but it's very common for people to work under the table simply because, as you can imagine, it's very hard to live in the United States sometimes for over a year without access to employment.
Yeah. Laura, I want you to weigh in here. You've been nodding your head throughout this entire portion of the conversation. How are people supposed to feed themselves, waiting 6 months to a year and a half even to be able to legally work?
Right. I mean, the only way to do it is through networks, right? Through having jobs that pay cash or doing things like construction, right? That usually there is that ability to go in and do that work. So, you know, people have to essentially just like ask around, right? And see where, you know, they'll be able to find employment. And I think the other thing I wanted to kind of mention in terms of like your question of like, do we have the bandwidth? I think that there's the immigration piece that, yes, the federal government definitely needs to just get more workers, get a better process. And there's also the legal part of it. If you're not working, you're not going to have money to pay a private attorney because that's going to cost you a lot of money. So a lot of these families are going to rely on non-for-profits that have immigration legal clinics to be able to do this work. And we are definitely, like, a lot of those organizations are at capacity, don't have the funding to be able to take on more cases, and especially cases that could take up to a year and a half.
Yeah. Ed, I want to bring you into the conversation and ask you to just piggyback off of what Laura just mentioned. Are people having to rely on the goodwill of individuals and organizations and churches.
Yes, and I can just say that it's going to require, and it currently is, a collaborative response by the community. No one organization can, you know, take care of these families and all of their needs. So we collaborate with others for legal assistance, for example, or for food. So we also have many medical doctors and dentists who will take a certain number of people in our care. So it's we really rely on the kindness of strangers, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. The people that ICDI serves are generally people without family or friends in the country, except, as Johanna said, sometimes they make a friend walking through the jungle on their way up here. But many have just heard, if you get here, you'll be safe and they'll take care of you. And so they head to the border.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, can they apply for government assistance?
As asylum seekers, they cannot, for the most part. Now, there are some state programs and some local programs that they might be able to access. But in terms of the federal government, they're not entitled to benefits until their asylum application has been granted. At that point, they can access, you know, Medicare and other federal programs, but not until that point.
Yeah. This is getting a lot of attention, Laura, as we mentioned earlier in the program, because in many ways it's a political stunt. People seeking asylum, though, they've been coming here before Governor Abbott started putting them on buses and shipping them here to the Chicago area. How do you think the general public should be understanding this moment, what's happening right now?
I mean, it's something that, as you mentioned, has happened for years, has happened since the beginning of this nation, right? So I think the larger public should really look at what the federal government is doing, right? And the fact that this isn't new. Immigrants coming into this country is not new, right? What's new, it's how it's happening, the amount of people that are coming in, and the fact that there has been no changes in immigration law since mm-hmm. 1996, right? It's actually getting harder for people to be able to adjust their status.
So how do you feel seeing stunts like sending a busload of migrants to the vice president's house?
Yeah, I mean, they're trying to make the point that immigrants, right, are a burden on society. And what we know is that, yes, it's going to take an effort and we're going to have to, like, all band together and collaborate and help them, you know, like these first couple of years, first couple of months. But what we do know is that immigrants are an asset to our state, to our city, that they are going to be contributing members of society, right? So it's all optics, because at the end of the day, if you look at the numbers, if you look at the contribution that immigrants make in this country, that's actually what we should be focusing on.
Absolutely. Ed, you have worked with people who have waited years for their applications to go through. Can you talk more about the toll that this takes on their lives? The process.
There's uncertainty in the family. Will we be able to, you know, when will we be able to secure work? When can we, and you put your children in school, you don't want daddy to be sent away. A lot of times if one partner is a newcomer to the country and they marry an American citizen, they can still be sent back to their country if they haven't gone through the proper steps for sponsorship, which also costs money and costs attorney's fees. So sometimes we have one family, daddy had four children with a citizen of the United States, and they sent him away, and she's home with four young children and unable to work because she's got the four kids. So it's very disruptive.
Wow.
To a family. Yeah.
Nicole, temporary protected status for Venezuelans, that's been extended. Is this a viable option? Is it faster?
It could be faster for some people. I will say that the way that temporary protective status works is that you have to be present in the United States when they announce the country is being added to the TPS list. And so it has been extended, but that doesn't mean that anybody who's coming to the border today from Venezuela is going to be able to apply unless they update that date by which someone has to be in the United States. So for many of the people who are coming right now, TPS is not going to be an option. And unless something changes, asylum will be the only way that they can stay.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about what could ease the asylum process for the newly arriving immigrants that have been bused here from Texas. Our guests are Ed Pratt, who's director of the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants, Nicole Hallett, who's director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic, and Laura Mendoza, immigrant organizer with the Resurrection Project. Ed, you've been asking lawmakers to introduce a law that would allow asylum seekers to be able to apply for work as soon as they submit that application. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, if they didn't have to wait 6 months after that application and is submitted. So what we've asked them to do is write the law that when you apply for asylum, you are then qualified to work. That would help a great deal. But as was mentioned, you know, you can be here a year before requesting asylum. And so if people don't know these laws, it's very, very confusing. And so they really need legal representation earlier, as early as they can get it. So when people are now getting off the buses at our hotel, we had an attorney come and share with them the different legal statuses that they might have in different avenues depending on how they came in. So, but most people just don't know that there are these laws, and they don't even know there's different ways to be an immigrant here.
I can definitely see that being the case for sure. It's a lot of information. Just one scan of the USCIS website, right? The U.S. immigration website. It is the most complicated website I've ever seen, and I'm speaking as an immigrant because I do have to visit that website and check out processing times for different forms and all kinds of things. It's a lot. So imagine this not being my native tongue. I don't speak English. This is not a familiar surrounding. There's no way I could navigate that.
Right. Also imagine, you know, coming off from like a really long journey and you're worried about how your basic needs are going to be met.
Right. Where am I sleeping tonight?
Right. So all of those things are in your head. And now you have to process and intake all of this information about immigration and your status.
What do you, Laura, want to see change with the asylum process personally?
I mean, I think there needs to be a lot of change. You know, when people are coming in at the border, they're getting wrong dates, you know, to present to immigration. They're being sent to different offices because they don't have necessarily a place. They don't know where they're going to land. And all of that, it's all paperwork. It's all manual. I think, you know, why are we still using paper forms? And part of the reason is because there's no money being invested, right, into making these processes better and faster so that people are able to go in, right? Mm-hmm. They need to hire more people to be able to actually take on the amount of work that is coming in, the amount of applications. People shouldn't have to wait a year and a half before they're able to kind of like start their lives.
Yeah. When we talk about housing people who are arriving by bus, we got to remember that this is happening against a backdrop of lack of affordable housing in this city in the first place. So to me, this is really heightening existing inequalities, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it is a problem. It's a huge issue that we have. And yes, we're adding more people to it. But I think, you know, immigrants will continue to kind of do what immigrants do, which is like figure out solutions for it. And, you know, that can mean sharing houses. I actually remember when we first came to the U.S. from Mexico, it was my uncle, my aunt, their family, and then my family mm-hmm. sharing like a 2-bedroom apartment. And that's how we were able to make it.
We did the same in Toronto. Like, we shared with my aunt and my cousin.
Yeah. So that's what, you know, a lot of people coming in are going to have to start doing is who can I room with? Who can I share this expense with in order to make it affordable?
Yeah. Ed, what does a partnership, in your view, what does a partnership with the city look like to meet the long-term needs of these migrants?
Well, we're working, ICDI is working with the city and the state to do that. We are trying to develop affordable housing, and that's taking a lot of not-for-profits collaborating in the city. Resurrection Project has been doing that for decades, and we need to continue to step that up. There's so many things we could do at the city level, but I think for us, many of the solutions are coming in from the state. They have more funds, and they have emergency funds that they can apply to this. So that's helpful.
Yeah.
I think the ultimate solutions are going to have to be federal. For example, the people coming in now are primarily Venezuelans and Nicaraguans. That's because Title 42 does not apply to them. Title 42 is where you couldn't come into the country because of COVID. And so they've been turning back. People lovingly call it the remain in Mexico policy. But we don't have formal diplomatic relations with Nicaragua and Venezuela, the actual government of Venezuela. So those people are able to come in and stay. But we need to remember how many tens of thousands of people have been pushed back into Mexico. So that's a federal solution.
It's ultimately
going to take the federal government changing some of these laws. But for the city, affordable housing and the mayor's office and the Department of Human Services, we're all working together as not-for-profits with those organizations.
Good. Nicole, what would you say to people who say that the way to fix this problem is just to dissuade immigrants from crossing the border?
Well, what I would say to that is that's been tried for decades and it hasn't worked. So it's not like the United States has had their arms open this entire time, and only now is it a problem. I mean, there have been people coming for forever, basically since the country was founded, and they will continue to come. And that's particularly the case when you have places that are unsafe and violent, and people are willing to do almost anything to protect their children, which I think we can all understand. So the solution is not going to be deterrence. It's a failed solution. It's been tried. It's been tried in many, many different ways. And what happens is that the system just gets more cruel. More people die, more people are detained, and yet people still come. So we need to come up with another solution that doesn't rely on convincing people that are afraid for their lives that they shouldn't try to make the journey.
Last word to you, Laura. What are you keeping your eye on moving forward?
Just making sure that these migrants that are coming in feel welcome, that we continue to collaborate with as many people as possible. So that is really the main focus, is making sure that they are welcomed into our city.
That was Laura Mendoza, immigrant organizer with the Resurrection Project, Ed Pratt, director of the Interfaith Community for Detained Immigrants, and Nicole Hallett, director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic at the University of Chicago's Law School. Thank you all. This episode of Reset was produced by Linnea Dominic. It was edited and mixed by Andrew Merriweather. Are you subscribed to Reset yet? If not, what are you waiting for? We have so many fascinating and surprising interviews to share with you. And when you do subscribe, leave us a rating. That really helps other listeners find us. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll see you tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.